Chapter 16. Once more he was within. He could no longer see or hear. It had been for a short time, and now it was over. The owl, hooting, flew on. Bill Keller said to the owl,
"Can you hear me?"
Maybe it could, maybe not. It was only an owl. It did not have any sense, as Edie had had. It was not the same. "Can I live inside you?" he asked it. "Hidden away in here where no one knows. You have your flights that you make, your passes." With him, in the owl, were the bodies of mice and a thing that stirred and scratched, big enough to keep on trying to live. "Lower," he told the owl. He saw, by means of the owl, the oaks. He saw clearly, as if everything were full of light. Millions of individual objects lay immobile, and then he spied one that crept. It was alive, and the owl turned that way. The creeping thing, suspecting nothing, hearing no sound, wandered on, out into the open. An instant later it had been swallowed. The owl flew on. Good, he thought. And is there more? This goes on all night, again and again, and then there is bathing when it rains, and the long, deep sleeps. Are they the best part? They are. He said,
"Ferguson don't allow his employees to drink. It's against his religion, isn't it?"
And then he said,
"Hoppy, what's the light from? Is it God? You know, like in the Bible. I mean, is it true?"
The owl hooted.
"Hoppy," he said from within the owl, "you said last time it was all dark. Is that right? No light at all?"
A thousand dead things within him yammered for attention. He listened, repeated, picked among them.
"You dirty little freak," he said. "Now listen, stay down here. We're below street level. You moronic jackass, stay where you are. You are, you are. I'll go upstairs and get those people. Down here you clear space, space for them."
Frightened, the owl flapped. It rose higher, trying to evade him. But he continued, sorting and picking and listening on.
"Stay down here," he repeated.
Again the lights of Hoppy's house came into view. The owl had circled, returned to it, unable to get away. He made it stay where he wanted it. He brought it closer and closer in its passes to Hoppy.
"You moronic jackass," he said. "Stay where you are."
The owl flew lower, hooting in its desire to leave. It was caught, and it knew it. The owl hated him.
"The president must listen to our pleas," he said, "before it is too late."
With a furious effort, the owl performed its regular technique. It coughed him up, and he sank in the direction of the ground, trying to catch the currents of air. He crashed among humus and plant growth. He rolled, giving little squeaks, until finally he came to rest in a hollow. Released, the owl soared off and disappeared.
"Let man's compassion be witness to this," he said, as he lay in the hollow.
He spoke in the minister's voice, from long ago.
"It is ourselves who have done this. We see here the results of mankind's own folly."
Lacking the owl eyes, he saw only vaguely. The illumination seemed to be gone, and all that remained were several nearby shapes. They were trees. He saw, too, the form of Hoppy's house outlined against the dim night sky. It was not far off.
"Let me in,"
Bill said, moving his mouth. He rolled about in the hollow. He thrashed until the leaves stirred.
"I want to come in."
An animal, hearing him, moved further off, warily.
"In, in, in," Bill said. "I can't stay out here long, I'll die. Edie, where are you?"
He did not feel her nearby. He felt only the presence of the Phacomelus within the house. As best he could, he rolled that way. Early in the morning, Dr. Stockstill arrived at Hoppy Harrington's tarpaper house to make his fourth attempt at treating Walt Dangerfield. The transmitter, he noticed, was on, and so were lights here and there. Puzzled, he knocked on the door. The door opened, and there sat Hoppy Harrington in the center of his mobile. Hoppy regarded him in an odd, cautious, defensive fashion. "I want to make another try," Stockstill said, knowing how useless it was, but wanting to go ahead anyhow. "Is it okay?"
"Yes, sir," Hoppy said. "It's okay."
"Is Dangerfield still alive?"
"Yes, sir. I'd know if he was dead."
Hoppy wheeled aside to admit him. He must still be up there. What's happened? Stockstill said. Have you been up all night?
Yes, Hoppy said. Learning to work things.
He wheeled the mobile about, frowning.
It's hard,
he said, apparently preoccupied. I think that idea of carbon dioxide therapy was a mistake, now that I look back on it, Stockstill said as he seated himself at the microphone. This time I'm going to try some free association with him, if I can get him to. The Facomalus continued to wheel about. Now the mobile bumped into the end of a table.
I hit that by mistake, Hoppy said. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Stockstill said, You seem different.
I'm the same. I'm Bill Keller,
the Facomalus said.
Not Hoppy Harrington.
With his right manual extensor, he pointed.
There's Hoppy. That's him from now on.
In a corner lay a shriveled, doe-like object several inches long. Its mouth gaped in congealed emptiness. It had a human-like quality to it, and Stockstill went over to pick it up.
That was me, the Facomalus said. But I got close enough last night to switch. He fought a lot, but he was afraid, so I won. I kept doing one imitation after another. The minister one got him.
Stockstill, holding the wizened little homunculus, said nothing.
Do you know how to work the transmitter? The Facomalus asked presently. Because I don't. I tried, but I can't. I got the lights to work. They turn on and off. I practiced that all night.
To demonstrate, he rolled his mobile to the wall, where, with his manual extensor, he snapped the light switch up and down. After a time, Stockstill said, looking down at the dead, tiny form he held in his hand, I knew it wouldn't survive.
It did for a while, the Facomalus said. For around an hour. That's pretty good, isn't it? Part of that time it was in an owl. I don't know if that counts.
I better get to work trying to contact Dangerfield, Stockstill said finally. He may die any time.
Yes, the Facomalus said, nodding. Want me to take that?
He held out an extensor, and Stockstill handed him the homunculus.
That owl ate me, the Fokey said. I didn't like that, but it sure had good eyes. I liked that part, using its eyes.
Yes, Stockstill said reflexively. Owls have tremendously good eyesight. That must have been quite an experience. This, that he had held in his hand, it did not seem at all possible to him. And yet it was not so strange. The Fokey had moved Bill only a matter of a few inches. That had been enough. And what was that in comparison to what he had done to Dr. Bluthgeld? Evidently, after that, the Fokey had lost track, because Bill, free from his sister's body, had mingled with first one substance and then another. And at last he had found the Fokey and mingled with him, too, had, at the end, supplanted him in his own body. It had been an unbalanced trade. Hoppy Harrington had gotten the losing end of it by far. The body which he had received in exchange for his own had lasted only a few minutes at the most.
Did you know?
Bill Keller said, speaking haltingly as if it was still difficult for him to control the Facomalus's body.
That Hoppy got up in the satellite for a while? Everybody was excited about that. They woke me up in the night to tell me, and I woke Edie. That's how I got here, he added, with a strained, earnest expression on his face.
And what are you going to do now? Stockstill asked.
The Fokey said, I have to get used to this body. It's heavy. I feel gravity. I'm used to just floating about. You know what? I think these extensors are swell. I can do a lot with them already.
The extensors whipped about, touched a picture on the wall, flicked in the direction of the transmitter.
I have to go find Edie, the Fokey said. I want to tell her I'm okay. I bet she probably thinks I died.
Turning on the microphone, Stockstill said, Walter Dangerfield, this is Dr. Stockstill in West Marin. Can you hear me? If you can, give me an answer. I'd like to resume the therapy we were attempting the other day. He paused, then repeated what he had said.
You'll have to try a lot of times, the Fokey said, watching him. It's going to be hard because he's so weak. He probably can't get up to his feet, and he didn't understand what was happening when Hoppy took over.
Nodding, Stockstill pressed the microphone button and tried again.
Can I go?
Bill Keller asked. Can I look for Edie now? Yes, Stockstill said, rubbing his forehead. He drew his faculties together and said, You'll be careful what you do. You may not be able to switch again.
I don't want to switch again, Bill said. This is fine, because for the first time, there's no one in here but me.
In explanation, he added,
I mean, I'm alone. I'm not just part of someone else. Of course, I switched before, but it was to that blind thing. Edie tricked me into it, and it didn't do at all. This is different.
The thin, folky face broke into a smile. Just be careful, Stockstill repeated.
Yes, sir, the folky said dutifully. I'll try. I had bad luck with the owl, but it wasn't my fault, because I didn't want to get swallowed. That was the owl's idea.
Stockstill thought, but this was yours. There is a difference. I can see that. And it is very important. Into the microphone, he repeated. Walt, this is Dr. Stockstill down below. I'm still trying to reach you. I think we can do a lot to help you pull through this if you do as I tell you. I think we'll try some free association today in an effort to get at the root causes of your tension. In any case, it won't do any harm. I think you can appreciate that. From the loudspeaker came only static. Is it hopeless? Stockstill wondered. Is it worth keeping on? He pressed the mic button once more, saying, Walter, the one who usurped your authority in the satellite, he's dead now, so you don't have to worry regarding him. When you feel strong enough, I'll give you more details, okay? Do you agree? He listened, still only static. The folky, rolling about the room on his mobile like a great trapped beetle, said,
Can I go to school now that I'm out?
Yes, Stockstill murmured.
But I know a lot of things already, Bill said, from listening with Edie when she was in school. I won't have to go back and repeat. I can go ahead like her. Don't you think so?
Stockstill nodded.
I wonder what my mother will say, the folky said.
Jarred, Stockstill said, What? And then he realized who was meant. She's gone, he said. Bonnie left with Gil and McConchy.
I know she left, Bill said plaintively. But won't she be coming back sometime?
Possibly not, Stockstill said. Bonnie's an odd woman, very restless. You can't count on it. It might be better if she didn't know, he said to himself. It would be extremely difficult for her. After all, he realized, she never knew about you at all. Only Edie and I knew. And Hoppy. And, he thought, the owl. I'm going to give up, he said suddenly, on trying to reach Dangerfield. Maybe some other time.
I guess I bother you, Bill said.
Stockstill nodded.
I'm sorry, Bill said. I was trying to practice, and I didn't know you were coming by. I didn't mean to upset you. It happened suddenly in the night. I rolled here and got in under the door before Hoppy understood, and then it was too late because I was close.
Seeing the expression on the doctor's face, he ceased. It's just not like anything I ever ran into before, Stockstill said. I knew you existed, but that was about all. Bill said, with pride,
You didn't know I was learning to switch.
No, Stockstill agreed.
Try talking to Dangerfield again, Bill said. Don't give up, because I know he's up there. I won't tell you how I know, because if I do, you'll get more upset.
Thank you, Stockstill said, for not telling me. Once more, he pressed the mic button. The folky opened the door and rolled outside onto the path. The mobile stopped a little way off, and the folky looked back indecisively. Better go find your sister, Stockstill said. It'll mean a great deal to her, I'm sure. When next he looked up, the folky had gone. The mobile was nowhere in sight. Walt Dangerfield, Stockstill said into the mic. I'm going to sit here trying to reach you until either you answer or I know you're dead. I'm not saying you don't have a genuine physical ailment, but I am saying that part of the cause lies in your psychological situation, which in many respects is admittedly bad. Don't you agree? And after what you've gone through, seeing your controls taken away from you... From the speaker, a far-off, laconic voice said,
"Okay, you Stockstill, I'll make a stab at your free association, if for no other reason than to prove to you by default that I actually am desperately physically ill."
Dr. Stockstill sighed and relaxed. "It's about time. Have you been picking me up all this time?"
"Yes, good friend," Dangerfield said. "I wondered how long you'd ramble on. Evidently, forever. You guys are persistent, if nothing else."
Leaning back, Stockstill shakily lit up a special deluxe gold-label cigarette and said, "Can you lie down and make yourself comfortable?"
"I am lying down," Dangerfield said tartly. "I've been lying down for 5 days now."
"And you should become thoroughly passive, if possible. Become supine."
"Like a whale," Dangerfield said. "Just lolling in the brine, right? Now, shall I dwell on childhood incest drives? Let's see. I think I'm watching my mother, and she's combing her hair at her vanity table. She's very pretty. Nope, sorry, I'm wrong. It's a movie, and I'm watching Norma Shearer. It's the Late Late Show on TV."
He laughed faintly. "Did your mother resemble Norma Shearer?" Stockstill asked. He had pencil and paper out now and was making notes.
"More like Betty Grable," Dangerfield said. "If you can remember her. But that probably was before your time. I'm old, you know. Almost 1,000 years. It ages you to be up here alone."
"Just keep talking," Stockstill said. "Whatever comes into your mind. Don't force it. Let it direct itself instead." Dangerfield said,
"Instead of reading the great classics to the world, maybe I can free associate as to childhood toilet traumas, right? I wonder if that would interest mankind as much. Personally, I find it pretty fascinating."
Stockstill, in spite of himself, laughed.
"You're human," Dangerfield said, sounding pleased. "I consider that good. A sign in your favor."
He laughed his old familiar laugh.
"We both have something in common. We both consider what we're doing here as being very funny indeed."
Nettled, Stockstill said, "I want to help you."
"Aw, hell," the faint, distant voice answered. "I'm the one who's helping you, Doc. You know that, deep down in your unconscious. You need to feel you're doing something worthwhile again, don't you? When do you first remember ever having had that feeling? Just lie there supine, and I'll do the rest from up here," he chuckled. "You realize, of course, that I'm recording this on tape. I'm going to play our silly conversation every night over New York. They love this intellectual stuff up that way."
"Please," Stockstill said, "let's continue."
"Hooty hooty hoo," Dangerfield chortled. "By all means. Can I dwell on the girl I loved in the 5th grade? That was where my incest fantasies really got started."
He was silent for a moment, and then he said in a reflective voice,
"You know, I haven't thought of Myra for years. Not in 20 years.
"Did you take her to a dance or some such thing?"
"In the 5th grade? Dangerfield yelled. "Are you some kind of nut? Of course not. But I did kiss her."
His voice seemed to become more relaxed, more as it had been in former times.
"I never forgot that," he murmured.
Static for a moment supervened.
"And then," Dangerfield was saying, when next Stockstill could make his words out, "Arnold Klein rapped me on the noggin, and I shoved him over, which is exactly what he deserved. Do you follow? I wonder how many hundreds of my avid listeners are getting this. I see lights lit up. They're trying to contact me on a lot of frequencies. Wait, Doc, I have to answer a few of these calls. Who knows? Some of them might be other better analysts," he added in parting, "and at lower rates."
There was silence. Then Dangerfield was back.
"Just people telling me I did right to rap Arnold Klein on the noggin," he said cheerfully. "So far, the votes are in favor, 4-1. Shall I continue?"
"Please do," Stockstill said, scratching notes.
"Well," Dangerfield said, "and then there was Jenny Linhart. That was in the low 6th.
The satellite in its orbit had come closer. The reception was now loud and clear, Or perhaps it was that Hoppy Harrington's equipment was especially good. Dr. Stockstill leaned back in his chair, smoked his cigarette, and listened, as the voice grew until it boomed and echoed in the room. How many times, he thought, Hoppy must have sat here receiving the satellite, building up his plans, preparing for the day. And now it is over. Had the Facomalus, Bill Keller, taken the wizened, dried-up little thing with him? Or was it still somewhere nearby? Stockstill did not look around. He kept his attention on the voice which came to him so forcefully now. He did not let himself notice anything else in the room. In a strange but soft bed, in an unfamiliar room, Bonnie Keller woke to sleepy confusion. Diffuse light, yellow and undoubtedly the early morning sun, poured about her, and above her a man whom she knew well bent over her, reaching down his arms. It was Andrew Gill, and for a moment she imagined, she deliberately allowed herself to imagine, that it was 7 years ago, E-Day again. "Hi," she murmured, clasping him to her. "Stop," she said then. "You're crushing me, and you haven't shaved yet. What's going on?" She sat up all at once, pushing him away. Gill said, "Just take it easy." Tossing the covers aside, he picked her up, carried her across the room toward the door. "Where are we going?" she asked. "To Los Angeles? This way, with you carrying me in your arms? We are going to listen to somebody." With his shoulder, he pushed the door open and carried her down the small, low-ceilinged hall. "Who?" she demanded. "Hey, I'm not dressed." All she had on was her underwear, which she had slept in. Ahead, she saw the Hardys' living room, and there, at the radio, their faces suffused with an eager, youthful joy, stood Stuart McConchy, the Hardys, and several men whom she realized were employees of Mr. Hardy. From the speaker came the voice they had heard last night. Or was it that voice? She listened as Andrew Gill seated himself with her on his lap.
"And then Jenny Linhart said to me," the voice was saying, "that I resembled, in her estimation, a large poodle. It had to do with the way my big sister was cutting my hair, I think. I did look like a large poodle. It was not an insult, it was merely an observation. It showed she was aware of me. But that's some improvement over not being noticed at all, isn't it?"
Dangerfield was silent then, as if waiting for an answer.
"Who's he talking to?"
she said, still befuddled by sleep, still not fully awake. And then she realized what it meant.
"He's alive,"
she said, and Hoppy was gone.
"God damn it," she said loudly. "Will somebody tell me what happened?"
She squirmed off Andrew's lap and stood shivering. The morning air was cold. Ella Hardy said,
"We don't know what happened. He apparently came back on the air sometime during the night. We hadn't turned the radio off, and so we heard it. This isn't his regular time to transmit to us."
"He appears to be talking to a doctor," Mr. Hardy said. "Possibly a psychiatrist who's treating him."
"Dear God,"
Bonnie said, doubling up.
"It isn't possible. He's being psychoanalyzed."
But, she thought, where did Hoppy go? Did he give up? Was the strain of reaching out that far too much for him? Was that it? Did he, after all, have limitations, like every other living thing? She returned quickly to her bedroom, still listening, to get her clothes. No one noticed. They were all so intent on the radio. To think, she said to herself as she dressed, that the old witchcraft could help him. It was incredibly funny. She trembled with cold and merriment as she buttoned her shirt. Dangerfield, on a couch up in his satellite, gabbling away about his childhood. Oh, God, she thought, and she hurried back to the living room to catch it all. Andrew met her, stopping her in the hall.
"It faded out," he said. "It's gone now."
"Why?" Her laughter ceased. She was terrified.
"We were lucky to get it at all. He's all right, I think."
"Oh," she said,
"I'm so scared. Suppose he isn't."
Andrew said,
"But he is."
He put his big hands on her shoulders.
"You heard him. You heard the quality of his voice."
"That analyst," she said, "deserves a hero first-class medal." "Yes," he said gravely. "Analyst hero first class. You're entirely right. He was silent then, still touching her, but standing a little distance from her. I apologize for barging in on you and dragging you out of bed, but I knew you'd want to hear.
Yes, she agreed.
Is it still essential to you that we go further on, all the way to Los Angeles?
Well, she said, you do have business here. We could stay here a while, at least, and see if he remains okay.
She was still apprehensive, still troubled about Hoppy. Andrew said,
one can never be really sure, and that's what makes life a problem, don't you agree?
Let's face it, he is mortal. Some day he has to perish anyhow, like the rest of us. He gazed down at her.
But not now, she said. If it only can be later, a few years from now, I could stand it then.
She took hold of his hands and then leaned forward and kissed him. Time, she thought. The love we felt for each other in the past. The love we have for Dangerfield right now. And for him in the future. Too bad it is a powerless love. Too bad it can't automatically knit him up whole and sound once more, this feeling we have for one another, and for him.
Remember Ide? Andrew asked.
Oh, yes, I certainly do, she said.
Any further thoughts on it?
Bonnie said,
I've decided I love you.
She moved quickly away from him, flushing at having said such a thing.
The good news, she murmured. I'm carried away. Please excuse me, I'll recover.
But you mean it, he said perceptively.
Yes, she nodded.
Andrew said, I'm getting a little old now.
We all are, she said. I creak when I first get up.
Perhaps you noticed just now.
No,
he said. Just so long as your teeth stay in your head as they are. He looked at her uneasily.
I don't know exactly what to say to you, Bonnie. I feel that we're going to achieve a great deal here. I hope so, anyhow.
Is it a base, onerous thing coming here to arrange for new machinery for my factory? Is that... he gestured. Crass?
It's lovely, she answered.
Coming into the hall, Mrs. Hardy said,
We picked him up again for just a minute, and he was still talking about his childhood. I would say now we won't hear again until the regular time at 4 p.m. What about breakfast? We have 3 eggs to divide among us. My husband managed to pick them up from a peddler last week.
Eggs? Andrew Gill repeated.
What kind? Chicken?
They're large and brown, Mrs. Hardy said.
I'd guess so, but we can't be positive until we open them.
Bonnie said,
It sounds marvelous.
She was very hungry now.
I think we should pay for them, though. You've already given us so much, a place to stay and dinner last night.
It was virtually unheard of these days, and certainly it was not what she had expected to find in the city.
We're in business together, Mrs. Hardy pointed out. Everything we have is going to be pooled, isn't it?
But I have nothing to offer.
She felt that keenly all at once, and she hung her head. I can only take, she thought, not give. However, they did not seem to agree. Taking her by the hand, Mrs. Hardy led her toward the kitchen area.
You can help fix, she explained. We have potatoes, too. You can peel them. We serve our employees breakfast. We always eat together. It's cheaper. And they don't have kitchens. They live in rooms, Stuart and the others. We have to watch out for them.
You're very good people, Bonnie thought. So this is the city. This is what we've been hiding from throughout these years. We heard the awful stories that it was only ruins, with predators creeping about, derelicts and opportunists and nappers, the dregs of what it had once been. And we had fled from that, too, before the war. We had already become too afraid to live here. As they entered the kitchen, she heard Stuart McConchie saying to Dean Hardy,
And besides playing the nose flute, this rat...
He broke off, seeing her.
An anecdote about life here, he apologized. It might shock you. It has to do with a brilliant animal, and many people find them unpleasant.
Tell me about it, Bonnie said. Tell me about the rat who plays the nose flute.
I may be getting two brilliant animals mixed together,
Stuart said as he began heating water for the imitation coffee. He fussed with the pot, and then, satisfied, leaned back against the wood-burning stove, his hands in his pockets.
Anyhow, I think the veteran said that it also had worked out a primitive system of bookkeeping. But that doesn't sound right.
He frowned.
It does to me, Bonnie said.
We could use a rat like that working here, Mr. Hardy said. We'll be needing a good bookkeeper, with our business expanding as it's going to be.
Outside, along San Pablo Avenue, horse-drawn cars began to move. Bonnie heard the sharp sound of the hooves striking. She heard the stirrings of activity, and she went to the window to peep out. Bicycles, too, and a mammoth old wood-burning truck, and people on foot, many of them. From beneath a board shack, an animal emerged and with caution crossed the open to disappear beneath the porch of a building on the far side of the street. After a moment it reappeared, this time followed by another animal, both of them short-legged and squat, perhaps mutations of bulldogs. The second animal tugged a clumsy, sleigh-like platform after it. The platform, loaded with various valuable objects, most of them food, slid and bumped on its runners over the irregular pavement after the two animals, hurrying for cover. At the window, Bonnie continued to watch attentively, but the two short-legged animals did not reappear. She was just about to turn away when she caught sight of something else moving into its first activity of the day. A round metal hull, splotched over with muddy colors and bits of leaves and twigs, shot into sight, halted, raised two slender antennae quiveringly into the early morning sun. What in the world is it? Bonnie wondered. And then she realized that she was seeing a hardy homeostatic trap in action. Good luck, she thought. The trap, after pausing and scouting in all directions, hesitated and then at last doubtfully took off on the trail of the two bulldog-like animals. It disappeared around the side of a nearby house, solemn and dignified, much too slow in its pursuit, and she had to smile. The business of the day had begun. All around her, the city was awakening, back once more into its regular life. This concludes the reading of Dr. Blood Money by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1965 by Ace Books, Inc. Copyright renewed 1993 by Laura Coelho, Christopher Dick, and Issa Hackett. This book was read by Tom Weiner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Philip K. Dick Trust, in care of Scoville Chichak Galen Literary Agency, Incorporated, and was produced in 2008 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.